This session is part of what we're calling BBF Unbound, and it's the first year for this program. At the Boston Book Festival, we pride ourselves on the quality and the depth and breadth of our programming. But if there's one thing that planning a book festival teaches you, it's that we certainly don't know everything. So that's why this year we invited proposals from community members and groups, because we know people are out there in the community doing really interesting things, and we wanted to learn about them. We got dozens of suggestions for sessions that are meaningful and valuable, but that we certainly would never have come up with on our own. So we're very excited about incorporating these new directions and new voices into our programming. We hope to expand this program going forward, so please keep your eyes open for calls for submissions for next year. And now I'm going to turn things over to Colin Halloran, who's the author of a collection of poetry shortly thereafter, who will lead us through today's session. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doc. They call me names, not like those kids in the back of the bus. Man, how time flies. These are different. Advent calendar, the Christmas tree, TCT in an acronym, Happy World. And my favorite, they call me Mr. Shingles. Pouches, tan on gray, one short of a dozen, strapped to the front of my vest. No chocolates to be found inside. 0.23 kilograms, that's roughly half a pound, HE, that's high explosive, rounds, grenades. The joys of being grenadier, 6 extra pounds of volatility, 5-meter kill radius, 15-meter CR, these are the things you need to know, knowledge to be effective in the field, knowledge that one round to the chest, a chest maybe 70% covered, will take out you and anyone unfortunate enough to be in that CR. Boom. So they call me Mr. Shingles. And we laugh. I laugh. Because what else can you do when you are set to blow? So there's a little shameless self-promotion for you. That's from my new collection, Shortly Thereafter, which is a collection of poems that documents kind of my entire military experience, pre-deployment, through deployment, and then what I tend to call the aftermath. And that's what we're here to talk about today is you know, how creative writing can help you come to terms with, intellectualize, and understand the aftermath in what you've been through. And also, the other side of that, how we can use writing to convey all of those experiences and what those experiences are like and how they change you to people who haven't been through it. You know, when I got back, and I think these guys will say similar things, I kept saying, you know, how could they possibly understand? How, you know, you come back home, and it's like the rest of the world has been going on, and you've been on pause, and you're expected to just pick up and keep doing exactly what it is that everyone else has been doing for this year that you've been just, like, on another planet. And it's frustrating, and you push people away, and, you know, how could they possibly understand? How could they possibly understand? And then after a couple of years of acting like this, something clicked in me, and I said, you know what, they can't possibly understand unless I tell them. But I can't tell them unless I understand. And so I started writing, and through my writing, I started understanding, and now I do things like this, where I share my words, I share my experiences in hopes of spreading an understanding that war is more than just this series of policies and numbers, you know, economic numbers, casualties, all of this. It's actually a human experience on both sides. You know, there are actual individual people who are going through these things that you're seeing on the news and reading about in the papers. And I feel like until we as a, you know, general population can kind of access what it's like to be the individual involved, we're not going to really be able to make as educated a decision as we should be making with such a big thing. So with me today are Lauren K. Johnson and Dario DiBattista, both veterans. There's stuff written about them in your program, and I'll let them say more about themselves. But we're going to try to keep this casual and leave plenty of time at the end for Q&A, which, you know, hopefully there's going to be some Qs because we've certainly got a lot of A's. I'm gonna turn it over to Lauren, who can say a little about herself and talk about one of the things that I think is most interesting about her perspective is that in the Air Force, she was a public affairs officer, and so her job was to essentially filter information that was going out to the general public. And I'll let her talk about how it's like to be out of uniform now and no longer have that filter and write about similar things, but as a creative writer. So, Lauren.
Thank you, Colin. I was kind of hoping that you would just go ahead and give my whole speech for me. I'm a little nervous. This is actually my first public presentation as a veteran writer, so I'm really thrilled to be here. Please, be nice. If I say something that sounds like it's supposed to be funny, please laugh. That's very encouraging to me. I've never worn one of these before, so it feels kind of weird. Can you guys all hear me okay?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I've heard that when you're nervous, it's good to start out by reading something that somebody else wrote. So I'm going to read a quote that I think is very fitting to what we are trying to do and what I think we all try to do as writers. This is from James Baldwin, The Creative Process. The state of birth, suffering, love, and death are extreme states. Extreme, universal, and inescapable. We all know this, but we would rather not know it. The artist is present to correct the delusions to which we fall prey in our attempts to avoid this knowledge. It is for this reason that all societies have battled with the incorrigible disturber of the peace, the artist. It's dramatic. But I feel like I, and I'm sure a lot of you, attempt in some fashion to be that incorrigible disturber of the peace. So that is part of what I'm going to try to communicate to you today. You'll learn a little bit more about Colin and Dario, but I think I would be remiss if I didn't first of all say that my war experience is very different from theirs. Everyone's war experience is different. We all are speaking from just our own tiny perspective in this crazy fabric that is war. Mine is different, obviously, because I'm female. That's kind of different. And also because I was an officer and I was in the Air Force, which basically means I'm a lot wimpier than both of these guys. I'm sure they will vouch for that.
Or smarter.
Yeah, that too. but I, when I went to war, I was not in a combat role. I was essentially a bureaucrat. My job was part of a provincial reconstruction team, which a PRT is assigned to every province in Afghanistan and basically tasked with providing government mentorship and building up the local infrastructure through civil engineering programs, working with local contractors. So trying to win hearts and minds, that tagline that you often hear that public affairs people put out there for you to latch onto. And as Colin mentioned, I was a public affairs officer, which in theory is very similar to writing nonfiction about the military. It's public affairs. We were trained to deal with facts, and that's exactly what I'm doing now. But in practice, it's completely different because public affairs has a priority, and that priority is to build trust and support in the military mission. So there is a filter involved in that, both for security purposes. Obviously, there's things in the military that you just can't talk about because you can risk people's lives. And to some extent, everyone in the military has to sacrifice a little bit of their freedom of speech. That's something everyone knows when they sign on the dotted line and raise their hand and take an oath, that in order to protect those freedoms, you have to give up a little bit of them yourself. It's kind of ironic. But public affairs plays an important role in that because they enable the military to tell these stories that otherwise would not be told. But it's also a very filtered version. It does not, like any news broadcast you see, like any third-party person telling someone else's story, it never captures that full reality physically, emotionally, and psychologically that the people on the ground are living and experiencing. especially when there are political and economic implications of those stories that are getting out. So it took me a long time after I got back from Afghanistan and got out of the military and had that beautiful, you know, amendment right to speak freely. I think that's my favorite amendment. But I still kind of consciously have to remind myself that I'm not being censored in what I say and what I write. It takes a long time to kind of reprogram your brain to do that. So I think that a lot of the stories that you do hear from people in war are focused on these very intense moments. And war is, for many people who go through it, defined by intense moments of combat engagement. And I have none of those to write about because I did not experience them. But for everybody at war, regardless of combat exposure, there are a lot of other moments in between that can also be very affecting. And one of the things that I strive to do with my writing is to tell those stories. For one, they can just be really weird and entertaining. War is a very idiosyncratic, kind of absurd environment. But it's also an environment where you're constantly exposed to stress and paranoia, and that wears on you. And as a female, and even males in deployed environments have to be concerned kind of in the back of our minds about, you know, potential sexual assault. It's the last thing you should have to worry about in a combat zone, but there are statistics and there are harrowing stories, and it happens to both men and women much more often than it should. So all of these things combined, and just that daily slog of stress and paranoia affects you really to your core, actually alters your brain chemistry. When you're exposed to a stressful situation, there's research that shows that it basically tweaks your brain so you're operating in this constant fight or flight mode and at a higher state of alertness. So that's one thing that Dario does with his work, is kind of working with writing to reprogram your brain cognitively to process those things in a more concrete, less crazy, overwhelming manner. So he'll talk more about that. But I want to touch on some of this non-combat side of war, because I think that it's something that people don't talk about, even in the military. I don't know how familiar everyone is with the military, but being emotionally vulnerable and talking about our feelings is not really encouraged. So people just don't talk about it. And because of that, everyone thinks that they're alone in whatever they're feeling. I struggled with that for a long time. I still, to some extent, struggle with that and trying to justify to myself that I, you know, had a reason for feeling this way, even though I hadn't been shot at, I hadn't been blown up, I hadn't killed anybody. You know, what right did I have to feel these, you know, PTSD-type effects that people who had been through those situations felt? And writing has a tremendous ability to create awareness of those issues so that both the sufferers feel a sense of community and that we have a group of educated supporters who are compassionate to what we're going through. And I keep a blog where I write about my experience transitioning back from Afghanistan and out of the military into the civilian world, because it's a big, scary world for people coming out of the military. And for me, that has been an incredibly eye-opening experience, and just the feedback I've gotten from other veterans who were not in combat but who have felt similar effects, and together we have kind of acknowledged that this is a big problem, kind of a universal problem, and it's just very comforting to know that we're not alone in that.
And where can these fine people add their own comments to that conversation?
Well, thank you, Colin. Always the salesman. My blog is uncamouflaged.blogspot.com, and I would spell it for you, but I always spell uncamouflaged wrong, so I'm sure you can figure it out. Google it.
It's well worth taking a look.
It's also on the Boston Book Festival website on my profile. But today I'm going to read a little something for you, focusing on these weird, absurd moments in between the craziness of war. It's about Beanie Babies, because war is weird like that, and that's why I love nonfiction. You just can't make this stuff up. I also write really long things. I have trouble keeping it under 10 pages or so. I have great respect for these guys and anyone who can boil down this crazy, overwhelming experience like war into a poem or flash prose. I can't do that.
So you just can't concentrate that long.
Oh, that could be it. But I'm going to read an excerpt of a longer piece. Basically, the premise that you need is there's a program, I'm actually not sure if it's still operational, but used to be in full swing, called Beanies for Baghdad, that was started by this woman in Indiana who had a surplus of Beanie Babies lying around. You know, there was a fleeting time where we all thought they were valuable. And she thought, well, I have Beanie Babies, and they're not valuable, so I will send them to Iraq and Afghanistan to give to deployed soldiers to hand out to local children as a way of building relationships. So I was the POC for my unit, and that should give you enough context to go forward. We brought them on missions with us. I never understood why the children were so fascinated by the American military. I like to think they saw us as their rescuers, riding in on our heavily armored steeds to pluck them from the grasps of insurgent control. But it's probably more accurate to call us aliens. Our big trucks were fascinating. So were our weapons and body armor, the brazenness with which we strode through their streets and burst into their homes. I was fascinating, a woman wearing the same uniform as the men doing the same work. And our stuff was endlessly, insatiably fascinating. The children were excited, not so much that they were getting cute, fuzzy, bean-stuffed toys, but something, anything, from the Americans. Except once. Once, at the rear of a dingy building, in the background of a meeting, I watched two girls lovingly prance their Beanie Babies across the aisle between them. It was a gentleness so rare in Afghanistan that I was unprepared to bear witness. My breath caught in my throat, and I felt my face crack and stretch into an unpracticed smile. Then I reached quietly into my bag and removed my camera. I needed this, evidence that gentleness still existed. Typically, it was chaos. The men were shouting inside and the boys were shouting outside, whether they were arguing about the number of locally hired security personnel needed to guard the newest stretch of the Coast Guardes Road, or grabbing for crayons or an empty water bottle or a single flip-flop sandal. It was a frenzy of screeching voices, knobby elbows, and dirty fingernails. Back on base, we experienced our own frenzy at mail time. In a place so cut off from the rest of the world, our twice-weekly, weather-dependent airdrops were a somewhat predictable source of comfort, a scheduled reminder that life existed outside Afghanistan. By the end of the deployment, we were all ordering and shipping items to ourselves just to hear our names at mail call. While we waited, our items made their way from their vendors to the cargo space of a commercial airliner, to Germany or Spain for redistribution and refueling, likely to Kuwait or Kyrgyzstan for further sorting. Then on to the military aircraft to the regional mail distribution center at Bagram Air Base, the military's main base in Afghanistan. Then on a smaller aircraft to eastern region hubs in Coast or Paktika provinces, and then finally by helicopter to Gardez, which has no fixed-wing runway, where our unit's mail was separated and loaded onto the back of a rickety cart driven by our personnel officer down the gravel walkway until, amid eager radio chatter, mail call in front of the bee huts, he and his load came to a stop next to the storage connex. A tangle of camouflaged sleeves. Sweet, my iPod came in. Hogan, one for Hogan, two for Granger. Expectant faces, excitement, and disappointment. We could always count on the Beanie Babies. At first, I opened the boxes alone in my office, rummaging through layers of bright plush, pulling out any pigs, insulting in Muslim culture, the American flag emblazoned bears, just a bit too overt, and any snacks or knickknacks that were buried underneath to be tossed into our morale pile for mass consumption. But then something happened that neither I nor the founder of Beanies for Baghdad could have predicted. Maybe it was the regularity of the packages in a place where nothing seemed regular. Maybe it was nostalgia in a place where comforts were few and far between. Maybe it was the diversion from the brown landscape and harsh gravel. Whatever the reason, I suddenly became very popular on mail days. It was mostly the women, but even some of the male soldiers loitered around while I sliced the packing tape off the familiarly addressed boxes. Over the pitter-patter of busy keyboards and the wind rattling the flimsy outer door, my office rang with cries of, "Oh, this one's so cute, I'm going to put it on my desk." It quickly became clear that many of the Beanies would never make it on a mission. One of my colleagues started a collection of sea creatures. By the time we left, she could probably have acted out every scene from The Little Mermaid. We could barely see our head medic behind the community of bears that inhabited her desk. I kept two cats perched next to a picture of my real cats. We came across a dinosaur that bore uncanny resemblance to the sword-wielding figure on one of the unit's patches, and the unit adopted him, using a Sharpie to make color corrections and gluing a plastic knife between his paws. At Christmas time, a parade of festively adorned beanies marched across the conference room table. Even the hard-headed, no-nonsense engineer who worked next door took a liking to a lemur with large, goofy eyes. One day, I threw the beanie over the wall that separated our offices. It had become a habit for my colleagues and his to launch all sorts of care package goodies back and forth. This is entertainment in a war zone. On this particular morning, though, all that came flying back was a comment about this one being especially ugly. Big Eyes spent the rest of the deployment displayed prominently on the engineer's desk. A few beanies even made it back to the States. Birthday bears were a popular item to send to loved ones at home, but occasionally another critter grabbed someone's attention. I remember one afternoon, a security forces soldier plucked a beanie from its box and held it out in his burly arm. The soldier's rifle slung across his chest rattled as he bounced excitedly, smiling through a cheek full of tobacco. "Hey, LT, mind if I take this one? I want to send it to my daughter. She loves pandas." I didn't think about it then, the irony of these well-traveled beanies making their way from their original homes to Indiana and through the Odyssey to Gardez, only to be boxed up and sent back in reverse. It is, I suppose, just one of the many ironies of war. Thank you.
So, I guess one of the reasons that we're all here, and like all of us at this entire event, is you know, a testament to the power of writing. But besides the fact that you're obviously quite good at it, why write? Why write about this?
Wow, I wasn't expecting a Q&A from you.
I'm a moderator. I'm moderating.
Well, quite frankly, I've always thought of myself as a writer. I was the kind of kid who would run around my backyard writing books in my head, I called it, just kind of reciting stories out loud. I never had a specific interest in nonfiction writing until I joined the military. And as part of the journalism piece of my public affairs career, I interviewed people for news stories and just was really fascinated by the stories that people had to tell. So that sparked my interest in nonfiction. I thought, you know, what a wonderful role to be this medium through which people can tell those stories and through which I can tell my own stories at some point when I have some. And thankfully, Afghanistan took care of that for me. I actually went through a very frightening period in Afghanistan where I couldn't write, which was, you know, part of my way of dealing with this stressful situation. I had been keeping a blog as kind of a supplement to my public affairs work to try to broadcast all of the wonderful things we were doing, and I got to a point where I just could no longer find that, you know, positive, non-worry-inducing spin to write about, and didn't want to worry my family, who were all reading my blog, so I just stopped writing in it and kind of closed a door that way. That was my way of dealing with, you know, instead of broadcasting things that I didn't believe in or didn't want to say, I just didn't broadcast anything. And it took me a long time to kind of pry that back open. And actually, applying for graduate school, I would say, kind of saved me in that sense, because I had to put together a writing portfolio. And for someone who doesn't want to dig back in and relive painful experiences, it probably wasn't the best decision to choose a nonfiction writing program. But I guess I'm a masochist, and I did it. And my very first workshop, I turned in a piece about my first visit to the mental health clinic at my Air Force base and kind of wrestling with this, you know, I'm an officer, I'm supposed to be strong and composed, and I just walked through the doors of this clinic, which basically means I'm not. And I had known these people for a day, and I basically laid my baggage out in front of them. And the feedback that I got from that was just overwhelmingly positive and encouraging, and showed me that people are interested in what I have to say. You know, people didn't judge me. They were just curious. They asked questions. They wanted to know more, and they were compassionate. And that I credit for keeping me going. That was a really long answer. I don't even know if I answered your question, but there you go.
I think so. That's all right. Public affairs officers, everybody. Dario, you know that question's coming your way in a little bit, but why don't you take over kind of talking a little more about working directly with veterans and how you've seen writing help others, as I think it's certainly helped all three of us.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of points that you guys have brought up, and I'll just piggyback on to get to the part of your question. I just want to make a note, though. I want some of that officer mail. My mail didn't even show up till like I got back. I was getting letters like 3 months later. This could have helped, you know, when I was in Iraq.
Yeah, smart, joining the Air Force.
Teasing. Why do we write about war? Well, why do we write about anything? You know, if you're writing of something of literary merit, the mandate is some sort of aesthetic about the human condition. But writing at its core is about conflict, and what's a bigger conflict than war? One point you made about the trauma, when you're a veteran, so much of the experience of coming back is how do I relate what happens to the people who are back home, who are concerned and want to help, but they don't know how to help. And to the central theme of this entire thing, how do you explain what is unexplainable? The challenge is inherent in the fact that the Iraq-Afghanistan war on terror experience is so fundamentally different than everything you did do in day-to-day life in America. Today, I walked around the Boston Book Fest. I walked up to random people and started talking, shaking their hands. I didn't look for snipers on the roofs. I didn't judge them to think if this is person somebody who wants to kill me. I had no concern for watching, keeping up to date with what Colin and Lauren were doing. In a combat zone, I'd be very worried about, okay, where are my people? What are they doing? What is my role? What is my principal direction of fire? You mentioned it rewires you. The things that guided you and provided safety, having a high-intensity rage, being very paranoid, watching everybody with skeptical eyes, really trying to analyze the situation, deciding if this person is trying to kill me, that was a directive from the commanding general of the Marine Corps, make yourself hard to kill, treat everybody like a friend, but expect that they want to kill you and have a plan to deal with that. It's a different circumstance. I'd much rather be here at Boston. My experience was basically, you know, like these guys, I went to war, I came back. I guess years later, you could have said I had survivor's guilt, post-traumatic stress, symptoms, whatever. You know, like a lot of guys, just really stubborn. I didn't really look into it. I kind of intuitively discovered writing as a way of doing that. And even that was kind of a funny story because I came back and that was when MySpace was becoming really popular. I know I'm kind of dating myself a little bit here. I know. Way back in 2004, and I was going through a bad relationship, and the girl started, you know, she had a blog, and she wouldn't use my name, but she would write about me. And I was like, oh, I'm going to start my own blog and write about you. But I guess like your experience, I started telling, you know, like, all right, I got a blog now. What am I going to talk about? And I started talking about some of my experiences overseas, things that were going through my mind, and I got a lot of encouragement to keep writing, just keep doing it. And it was important for me to be able to tell that story because writing is taking higher functions of the brain to give order to a story or a traumatic event. You didn't learn how to write. You weren't born and raised and you know, started creating Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, materials. Maybe Cormac McCarthy did, I don't know. Trauma, and this is something, moving forward, I work with an organization now called the Veterans Writing Project. We're based out of D.C. We're a 501c3 nonprofit. We got one of our alums here, which is outstanding. I can't believe I'm in Boston and running into somebody who I taught at our seminar a while ago. We work at two levels. There's three main missions that we have. One, we want to help other veterans tell their stories so they can share, create the awareness that we're talking about. How do you understand? Part of it is engaging yourself with literature, the works of others, and having those things. It's the greatest thing about literature. I'm never going to be a prostitute in India. I'm never going to go through the Holocaust. I'm never going to walk hopefully have to deal with some sort of atomic event, but I feel better for reading and read Hiroshima, Night by Elie Wiesel, all those kind of books. You know, it's what we like about it. It's the experience. It's a gift. Good literature is a gift. Somebody's giving you a brand new way of thinking, a new understanding, a new empathy that you didn't have before. That's why I think a lot of us are doing this writing. With the Veterans Writing Project, we also do work at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. I have MA after my name, not PhD. Basically, the research shows when people do writing as some sort of expressive therapy, they have less hospital stays, better satisfaction of living. They have better sleep time. All the tangibles are there. It's maddening because if anybody has ever thought about studying art therapy, you can do art therapy for dance, painting, sculpting, whatever, but there is no writing therapy. It doesn't exist. I know. Scratch your head. Here we are, 2012. I don't know what's going on. So to answer your question, that's the reason I write. That's the reason I think war or issues of war, whether they are I survived the Battle of Fallujah or I dealt with the inner conflict of being thousands of miles away from home, wondering about what my girlfriend's doing back in the States, are the powerful stories that are resonant throughout us all because we have a shared humanity. And there is a therapeutic benefit to it, which I can't necessarily make concrete science, but I've lived it, and I see other people are living it too. And that's the other benefit of what we do. Oh, yeah.
You look like you're poised to read something there.
Well, she had a, piggybacking on the officer here, smarter brain functionings. This is our book. This is written by my mentor and friend, Ron Capps. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. His job was, hey, there's something crazy going on in DeFore. We need somebody to go and report on what that is. He saw a lot of death. He saw a lot of violence. He's been to every combat zone in the world. And at some point, he shut down. And we met each other at our graduate writing program at Hopkins. And again, I believe on the power of writing. You know, and I hoped, one day to have a prestigious university position somewhere where I'd help young people, through writing. I believe in the power of nonfiction, fiction, poetry, and helping illuminate ourselves, all that therapy. So it's a real honor and privilege for me to have a job at the National Military Medical Center, Walter Reed, at Bethesda, and also be working with this group. There's a quote in here, which I think is another mandate to the reason that we write. It's by Oliver Wendell Holmes. This opens our book. Writing War. We offer free seminars to veterans, current service members, interested organizations, families, and basically it's an MFA in a weekend. You sit in, we teach you all about setting, theme, point of view, narration. There's a little bit about trauma, why we write, how to write, and then your new life as a writer. This opens up the book. The generation that carried on the war has been set apart by its experience. In our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. It was given to us to learn that life is a profound and passionate thing. While we are permitted to scorn nothing but indifference, we have seen with our own eyes, and it is for us to bear the report to those who come after us.
All right, moderation time again. So it's really cool to see how, the three of us are here because of events like this. Dario and I met, was that 2009?
Way back.
Yeah, 3 years. Almost 4 years. But we met at this, kind of quasi-experimental conference at a university in Connecticut that was a Veterans Voices writing conference. And, there wasn't a lot of that sort of thing going on. And, the keynote there who led a workshop with us, and it was a very small group of us that were there, was Tony Swofford, who wrote Jarhead. And that was kind of it at that point in time, as far as, military writing coming out of, the last two decades is pretty much Jarhead. And then, you start seeing more and more coming out with Brian Turner's books, Hear Bullet and Phantom Noise. And then, the Veterans Writing Project popping up, and more and more interest. Dana Gioia helped put together an anthology with the National Endowment for the Arts a few years back. But it's been a while, and that ball is rolling again because of people like these guys who are going out and starting to tell their stories. And quick plug for all of us, actually. We're all going to be, all three of us will be featured in an anthology that's being put out by the Missouri Council for the Humanities and the Warrior Arts Alliance. It'll be out at the end of next month. It's being put out by Southeastern Missouri State University. And it's 256 pages of writing by veterans, which is just astounding to me. And you do see more people. And Lauren and I also met at a conference earlier this year, where I was giving a talk somewhat similar to this out at AWP in Chicago, and about a week before I got this email that says, "I'm not a stalker, but..." And, you know, she told me a little bit about herself, and then again assured me that she wasn't a stalker, this person I had never met that found me online and emailed me. And so we met, you know, I said, "Great, like, I'm so glad that you're interested in my panel and that, you know, that someone's actually paying attention out there." And now it's like more and more you're seeing these types of panels come up and this type of writing come up. And I think that's great because, you know, I do a lot of work in high schools, and it astounds me that, you know, when I'm working with a class of high school sophomores, so they're about 14, 15 years old, literally as long as they can remember, we've been at war in Afghanistan. Yeah. For their entire, it's normal for them. And war is not something that should be normal. And I think that's one of the things that, especially with Lauren's writing, really stands out to me, is how she takes this not normal thing and applies everyday items like Beanie Babies and Barbie and countless other everyday items that we as a, you know, general public understand. And as veterans and as writers, we can use those tools, we can use things that people know and understand to help bridge that gap in knowledge. Now, another thing that I talk about a lot is, and Dario touched on it, and that's the, you know, reading work by other people that doesn't necessarily, I mean, without readers, there would be no writers. It's such a beautiful symbiosis. And I was honestly a little disappointed to hear that you'll never be a hooker in Indiana, but, you know, you can access that emotional understanding, and there's, you know, this kind of dichotomy between the emotional landscape and the physical landscape. And so I can, you know, read a book about Afghanistan, like Kite Runner, that is beautifully written and such a wonderful read, but I don't necessarily connect to that as much as, say, The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, which is a completely different physical landscape, but the emotional landscape is identical. And so by reading others and by continuing to produce our own work, you know, the goal, I think, is to get that emotional understanding out there to people who have that shared experience and also to the people who have no idea what that's like. And that's certainly one of the reasons that I write is, you know, to kind of throw the question back at myself, is, you know, A, to understand my own experiences. You know, intellectualizing the war experience is so valuable in kind of taking a step back and applying that higher order thinking and reaching some level of understanding beyond the emotional mess that you've become. I totally just lost train of my thought there. I was just thinking about what an emotional mess I've been. another side of that is I was able to step back and start writing this book. And it was a very long process and a very difficult process in which I actually had to leave the country, and I went and I lived in England because I had to get away from the physical space that was impeding on my emotional space, because this place that called home was exactly how I left it, this small town in New England. absolutely beautiful. Everyone still knows your name, but I was not the same. And that made it so that I couldn't write about my experiences. So I removed myself from the physical space that I could really get into the emotional space. And it was difficult. And it took me a solid year and a half, 2 years before I, you know, really started saying, wow, I need a little help here. And writing was that help for me. And I don't want people to have to go through what I've been through. And so I figure if I can act as almost a proxy for other vets and give them my voice while they're trying to find theirs, maybe, you know, we can all just kind of help each other heal. And that was, I mean, I think it was the first time that we ever had a conversation. You had read some of my work and said, you know, essentially, it's like you just reached into my head and took what was going on in there and put it on a page. And it's a shared experience, but Lauren said, you know, we in the military culture, you don't talk about it. But if you don't talk about it, you're not going to understand it. And if we can't understand it, you can't understand it. And perpetual cycle, it's just going to keep on going. So I think that's why we write. I think it's interesting that all of us have found ourselves writing about other things and then realized that it was kind of, you know, whether it was for me writing about my grandfather or for Dario publicly embarrassing his ex-girlfriend.
It wasn't a very well-read blog.
Well, you know. People are going to find it now. They're going to go out searching for it.
It's deleted, though.
Yeah.
MySpace.com.
It's, you know, it happens. But, you know, it's definitely a tool, and it's a tool that we can all use, and that hopefully, you know, I mean, there's a reason that you're all sitting in this room. You know, I know there's a couple of rows of people that are here because they're Lauren's classmates, which is great. Thanks for coming, guys. but there's a reason that we're all here, and you know, especially with all this talk of, you know, this time of year, with all the talk of politics and policies, it's so easy to forget. You know, everyone's talking about Election Day. No one's talking about Veterans Day, which is only a week after that. And it's so easy to forget that these are actual people over there. That, you know, they're saying 2014 will bring X number home. And it's like, well, each one of those X's has a name and has people around them. And if anyone in here is, you know, a friend or a family member, loved one, whatever, of someone who's been through a deployment, you know, I encourage you to read, to find out, and there's so much research going on now. We're at this beautiful point where science is catching up to art, where technology is allowing us to actually look into people's brains and see how it's working. And, you know, there's this really cool new thing where it's like a targeted magnetic beam that they can say, okay, we know exactly where PTSD symptoms come from. We are going to hook you up to this machine. We're going to scan your brain, figure out exactly where it's located, and we're going to send like high-powered magnet beams into your brain, and you're going to be happy. And it's so cool that we can actually do that. But I was having a conversation with a research psychologist who's involved in the testing of that here in Boston. And we were having this conversation yesterday about how, you know, she had purchased my book and had read it and was basically telling me it's, for her as a scientist, all she sees are the numbers. But then to be able to fill out those numbers with the actual emotional side of what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, allows her to have such a better understanding. And I know that certainly one of my goals is to get others to write, and that's why I'm so excited about the work that Dario is doing down in DC with Veterans Writers Writing Project, to get other people to start writing and sharing their stories so that, again, we can get that understanding.
I also want to be a rock star and make lots of money.
Yeah. That's why he writes nonfiction, because he wants to make money. I'm a poet. I've accepted it. So yeah, that's, you know, I guess the bottom line is that the whole hearts and minds thing, you know, Lauren did it from the Beanie Babies standpoint. we in the infantry looked at hearts and minds a little, you know, they say, go win hearts and minds, and we would say, two in the heart, one in the mind, which is horrible. But there's this dark humor that you pick up when you're constantly surrounded by death, and you know, then you come back here and you're not anymore, and that's one of the reasons that the adjustment is so difficult. But I think that it's important to remember that the battle for hearts and minds doesn't end when we set foot back in this country, and that we need to be able to win our own hearts and minds and come to terms with what we've been through and then go out there and share the story with people like you. So,
just one note on that, and this is also why I think panels like these are important. You know, as a process of writing about war and coming back and all the traumas and psychological disorders associated with that, I've done some research. The VA says there's a 18% PTSD prevalence rate, which most vets will tell you is pretty much BS. It's probably a lot higher. But their admitted number is the population of New Orleans. It's 360,000. It's a lot of people. If we can, through something as simple as a workshop, here's how to write. Here's how to write 15 minutes a day. These are the benefits of doing this and how it might impact you. Well, that's going to help out our country a lot. You know, obviously, healthcare and those kind of issues are big political hot-button topics, but I don't understand how it doesn't make sense that you help people help themselves, you give them better resources, then they don't become a burden to everybody else.
I just want to add a note on that also. One of the things that concerns me about PTSD, and I know I at least speak for Colin, I'm sure Dario as well, is the conversation around it. For a long time, PTSD is still very stigmatized, and for a long time, the military and the VA dealt with that by just not talking about it. And as the as we have people like Sergeant Bales, who went out and allegedly murdered 16 civilians in southern Afghanistan, and they're calling that a manifestation of his PTSD. And as we get Army suicide rates that are now eclipsing combat as the lead cause of death in the Army, and people are saying, hey, there's something to this PTSD, maybe we should talk about it. But then the way they talk about it is sensationalized. And these people like Sergeant Bales, people who go on Dr. Phil's show called PTSD Takes Veterans from Heroes to Monsters, and the examples are a guy who set his wife on fire and a guy who beats his wife. And these are the public faces of PTSD, whereas there are a lot more people like us who are dealing with these issues than there are like Sergeant Bales. But employers don't want to hire Sergeant Bales, and people don't want to interact with Sergeant Bales. Certainly, a wife doesn't want to marry someone who's going to set her on fire. So creating awareness about the underlying issues and the many different manifestations and ways of dealing with these issues is important to prevent veterans from stigmatizing each other and being stigmatized by the civilian community. And how are we supposed to view ourselves when those are the kind of messages that we're hearing? So it's just overall an important conversation we need to have and how we look at that and how we deal with it as a society, because it is a whole societal problem.
Yeah. Questions?
We write. That's what we do. That's why we do it. So, yeah. I guess we'll open this up to some questions. We've got about 15 minutes left. There is a microphone over there, so that everybody can hear the question, and we don't have to waste time repeating questions.
I guess just form a line, maybe.
If you want to form a line over there, I will say again. We're at RAB Auditorium. I will be down there signing. You can, come talk to us after. Dario's unfortunately got to
I'll hang out
peace
for
out
bit.
And try to beat Frankenstorm back down to Maryland.
Yeah, I'll hang out for a little bit, though.
And also down there, we do have copies of the order form for the Southeastern Missouri State University anthology, which is called Proud to Be. And I think that we are all certainly proud to be a part of that.
Yeah. So. Oh, hi. I'd like to know Dario's last name, and would he read something, please?
I told told you you should read something.
I'll read something. This is from memory. This is my poem that'll be coming, forthcoming in the anthology you talk about. I do poetry con. I
have an essay being published in the anthology. I know. So it's,
It's called Sonnet for Killing, and there's some profanity, so I apologize. In Huseba, the men in pixel gear and bullet jackets occupy the town with armored trucks and brawn. I'll get something right for you. I'll pull it right up. I put me on the spot. I'll pull something up to read. I don't have it memorized. I apologize.
And your name?
Oh, D. Batista. I have a website, all that stuff. I have a memoir forthcoming. I wish I had more details about that, but I don't right now. There's links to my writing there. I've been blessed to get some stuff out there, so yeah.
Two things. Excuse me. Number one, thank you for your service. And thank you for an outstanding presentation this morning. I really enjoyed it. One of the things you all three closed with was PTSD. My question is, what factor does the rules of engagement play in PTSD? Because the more I read, the more confused and frustrated I am about the rules of engagement on our military.
I was very frustrated by the rules of engagement as well. Things have changed a little bit, in Afghanistan in the last 6 years from when I was there. When I was there, the police and the military didn't have uniforms. And so there was a guy walking around with an AK-47. He could be a farmer protecting his crop. He could be about to open fire. He could be on my side. You have no idea. And I think that, the not having the ability to, necessarily engage in that situation, or knowing that, okay, if you roll into a village and you see no women and children, you know something's about to go down, but you can't take care of that. You have to wait until you are fired on, and if you cannot pinpoint exactly where that fire is coming from, there's nothing you can do. And I think that certainly plays a role in my PTSD. I've got it. I've been in treatment for it. I've written about it a lot. I guess I never really thought about how the rules of engagement have impacted that. I was just going to say that's something I'm going to have to think about more.
One situation I had to deal with is when I was on the Syrian border with the Marines. I was attached to 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, as a civil affairs person doing the street level stuff of what Lauren was talking about. But, back then it was more combat. There wasn't a lot of hearts and minds, really. You and you're a Marine, you're trained as a rifleman first, so I was basically a machine gunner. One day on patrol, there was a vehicle coming up, which I made the decision was not a suicide bomber, but I was ordered to shoot, but I didn't. I didn't think it was a suicide bomber because it was a small vehicle. Usually a suicide bomber would have like a big vehicle to put lots of explosives in, and there was also 5 people in it. To me, it didn't make sense to kill 5 people once, when if they wanted to be suicide bombers, you could utilize them 5 separate times. So I made the right decision from a human standpoint, but a year and a half later, I was out at a bar. The bartender comes to me and says, "Hey, Dario, this woman over here just had her husband killed in Iraq." He knew me well. I was always at the bar. And I went over to talk to her. Turns out I helped recruit her husband. He was in the same space, and he was killed by a suicide bomber. So I wondered, did the implications of me not doing that make the insurgency think that the Marines in this area are weak? Because they're always watching. Somebody's always watching to see what you're going to do, see how you're going to react, see what your tactics, techniques, and procedures are. And that's a story I wrote about for the Washingtonian, if anybody's interested. It's on my website.
And that constant waiting, I think, is definitely, and this is something that Lauren's written about, it's that constant waiting for something to happen is so often more stressful than when it's actually going on because you don't have control. You don't know what is about to happen, whereas in the actual action, you do have some level of control. And so I think that the waiting that comes along with the rules of engagement is definitely playing a part.
I'm wondering what your experiences, if you could talk a little bit about when you're in high schools and whether you think there should be, I guess in a large general sense, how do you think America should try to educate its youth about war?
They should all buy my book. So unfortunately, this does have to be the last question I'm being told by this little orange sign here, but we are going to be available. I see there's more people with questions. We're certainly going to be available for you. I am a very strong advocate of interdisciplinary studies, using literature in the history classroom. You know, like I was talking about with the science and literature combining to create a fuller understanding, it's the same thing with history. You know, history textbooks, you know, you have, 20 pages on World War II? I'm sorry, there's a lot more than 20 pages that were happening. So read Miklos Radnati's Clouded Sky. Get that emotional understanding. And again, you know, high school student, one of the reasons I love working with high school students is not just because I used to be a teacher, but also because these are the people who are then going to be going to college and then getting out of college and then making decisions down the road. And they need to understand. And so I'm a huge advocate, and I've done workshops for teachers as well on incorporating poetry into the history classroom and literature into the history classroom and teaching literature and history side by side so that students can gain a fuller understanding of what's going on.
If I may add to that, and this will answer both questions because I'll tie that into a reading. One of the advisors for the Veterans Writing Project is a woman named Kelly Kennedy. She's a best-selling author of a book called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. I teach at the Community College of Baltimore County. I teach English 101. I had the students read that book. To them, war is just a video game. You jump out of a building, you get killed, you say, oh shit, and then you come back to life and keep running around the field and doing that. They were very disconnected from that. But again, when you have that literature, when you have that writing, it's an experience you can't escape from. I told them, I don't care what your opinion is, but you will have one after you read this book. There's no way that you can't. And I think they developed a lot of sympathy and empathy for the soldiers. That book impacted me in a really strong way. There's a scene, they had an AAV, what do they call them in the Army? It was a carrier for troops, and it got blown up by a really, really big improvised explosive device, killing all 16. And she was reporting that when they were bringing the bodies back, they came in these bags. But she said that couldn't be them, because it was just small parts. This poem's called Body Bags. How am I to decide whose parts are whose? The mortuary Marines will need to piece together the remains, and what's never recovered will be shaded black on their paperwork. But there are so many parts, and I can't tell who's Taliban or civilian or a brother I loved. I pick up the blackened fingers in the gasoline mud and the pieces of the charbroiled carcass that don't crumble when I lift them. I grab the thighless legs, boots still attached, and the jawbone. I hold the body bag over my shoulder, unimpressed by the weight of what remains of mighty men.
That's a great place to end it. Again, we're going to be available for questions and then signings in RAB Auditorium, I believe it's called. So thank you all so much for coming. Please spread the word.